today. Now, where will rates go and what does it all mean? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one that is post covering finance and broad news with this distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by Steve from Canstar. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Martin.
Great to have you on again. And we need to pick up the conversation from last month because, of course, the RBA did it again. But there's some really concerning, interesting, unusual dynamics in the market now, and I want to pick that apart with you.
Yeah, look, there are. One of the most interesting things in the market that I'm kind of a little bit stunned by is that house prices are falling and rents are going up. Now, that's kind of an unusual mix. And I look at it and I think, well, wow, what's going to happen when all of this migration takes off? And I'm quite concerned about that because I think, well, it says that we and vacancies are way down. Now, it says that we have a massive housing shortage already, and I'm not seeing that we're going to be able to fix that in the next 12 months. I mean, it's going to take a while before you can actually address that. We've already got building shortages, as we know, trade shortages, building supply shortages, all that stuff. So I think that's one of the strangest anomalies that I'm seeing at the moment.
I agree with you. It's interesting because if you look at it, statistically speaking, there are a lower count of available rental properties either for rent or being leased at the moment. In other words, some property investors have actually hopped out the market. The reason they've hopped out the market is because they saw this massive appreciation over the last couple of years, thanks to ultra low interest rates and all of the COVID stimulus and support. They then started to see property prices sort of go sideways and they're thinking, well, hang on a moment. Maybe I should capitalize on that equity expansion that I got. And that's actually hitting a lot of property investors at the moment. So the stock is going down. As you say, the stock of new is not meeting that. And then we've got this inflation pressure coming in from those migrants who are going to be predominantly wanting to rent as well. It's a really weird situation. And unfortunately, I think it's another example of a broken market.
Yeah, I think it is actually. The market is broken on the supply side and it hasn't been addressed in years. State governments sort of are the people who supposedly manage that and they haven't managed it. And federal governments haven't taken a lead on it, which is kind of very disturbing because it's been coming down the chute for quite a while. But I guess it was papered over during COVID because of no tourism, no migration. But that was only papered over. And when we return to normal in both of those markets, we will have a problem because we already have a problem. And everybody who's a renter will tell you that they go to rent a place, there are 20 or 30 applications, they're paying 6 months up front so that they secure the thing and they're prepared to pay more than the asking rent. And people renewing are paying another sort of $100 a month or $50 a week or something. So it's everywhere. It's not just the anecdote. It's everywhere. It's in the broader statistics. And you can't put up houses overnight. You can build little part-time ghettos maybe quickly, but I don't know that you want to do that. You don't want to bring people into the country to be living that way.
No, I agree. And it's also interesting observation with regard to the rental question. In my surveys, I measure rental stress from a cash flow perspective, and we've actually got more renters having a cash flow issue with their rents than we have mortgage holders. So the whole rental sector and the pressure on households, and predominantly what I'm finding is that even those who are a little more affluent are finding the rents a real pressure point now, plus of course all of the other costs of living and electricity and things. But rental stress is a really big thing, and what's happening is that's forcing some people to look for lower priced rental accommodation, but a long way out, and in some cases frankly renting property that is really not very salubrious just to find somewhere to live. But there is a housing crisis here, and I'm afraid that both state and federally they've dropped the ball.
Yep. As I said before, it's just been coming at us for a long time, but it was COVID just disguised it and sort of didn't punish governments for doing nothing. And, you know, it's red tape, it's lack of proper planning, as in urban planning. We've kind of said, well, look, it doesn't matter how many people we bring into the country, the market will respond to it. Well, the market would respond to it if some of the controls were removed. But maybe it goes a little bit further, because you look at the build of our cities, and unless you're really prepared to say, look, we will introduce a denser style of city than Australia has had in the past, we just will have trouble coping. People coming into the country come to the places where there are employment opportunities, and they're really the big capital cities and a couple of regional centres. That's where they go because they want a better life and they want a better job and all the rest. We have to accept, if that's the approach, that we need, we will have more density in our major cities.
I think there's one other observation there. Of course, the quality of the high-rise construction of recent years is also pretty appalling. So there's a whole bunch there of building standards and controls and planning, all of those things. So whilst on one hand the industry will say, release the controls, let us build more stuff, we do need to have the right regulatory frameworks to make sure that the quality of materials are used and the buildings work for the long term. Otherwise, what you're going to do is to create high-density ghettos, and that's going to create a bigger problem down the track. And in fact, already in some parts of Sydney, for example, North Ryde is the one I use. You know, there are horrendous stories there in North Ryde where there was a lot of stuff built back in the mid-2000s, 2010, 2015. Property prices there peaked in 2017 for units. They're still lower today. And the reason is because it's such poor quality of construction. So it's not just a simple matter of building more stuff. We've got to build the right stuff.
Yeah, you stole my thunder yet again, Mark.
Sorry.
I was going to use the word ghetto as well. Yeah. Because I think that's a massive risk. But you look at most major cities around the world that have already made the decision about density, and they have generally mismanaged it and built ghettos. It's not apparent immediately, but it's apparent 10 years down the track with buildings that look shabby because they've been badly made and are shabby because they've been badly made. And I think there's something more to it than that too. I think there's building in with developments a lifestyle and a community style, because I mean people living in isolation in high-rise buildings in little boxes, it creates awful social problems. Yep. And you need to build an opportunity for socialization in developments as well, and that means green space and it means community space, whether it's sort of within a single building or within a precinct. And I think that will be the thing that will save us from ghettos, because you can do it in a nice way that really supports a good lifestyle for people and good societal outcomes, or you can do it in a terrible way where people just live shabby little lives.
Yeah, unfortunately, some of the decisions are merely taken on profit outcomes rather than social outcomes, and I actually believe that there needs to be a whole social dimension and community dimension to the way we think about housing. Because if I go to the urban fringe, for example, where you've got low density development but on very small plots but no infrastructure, so from a lifestyle perspective, and I said in my surveys, a lot of people out in the urban fringe have to go miles or kilometers just to get basic services, and they're spending a lot of time and money just to get around because the infrastructure part of it was not actually in the plan. So it comes back to joined up thinking. It comes back to understanding that you can't just throw up a high rise or a low rise and magically everything else is fixed. You have to do the thinking again, in a joined up way. And I have to say, I think, again, state and federal and actual local authorities are actually all partly to blame here. Nobody wants to deal with these really complicated things. And it's going to be at the detriment of Australia down the track.
Yeah. There are some visionary developments that have been done in recent years in Australia. And I can think of one in Brisbane. I won't mention the name of it, but it's a huge, huge, huge development. And it built they built in employment opportunities within the development. They built in all sorts of green space, all sorts of social facilities, and you know they did the whole shebang. Yep. Plus negotiated the rail link with the state government. Extraordinary development, and it's sort of on the outer rim, but it's not that far out. And because it's got a rail link, it's connected. And it's such a great model. Now, that's still, though, suburban blocks. And I don't think the thinking has really gone to the higher density style. And I just don't think people have thought that one through. And it's a tough challenge. It's probably a tougher challenge. But it's the one that we really do have to address, because there's no other obvious solution to the higher population who will be wanting to live in the three big cities, I guess.
Mm. Well, there certainly are a few leading thinkers in this space, but unfortunately, we need everybody to think differently, not just to maximise the dollar, I think. But hey, that's a bit of an unconventional but very important thing, I think, in the current environment.
I think it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Now let's move on and talk more broadly about rates. So the RBA lifted rates. It's interesting that CBA almost immediately then upped their rate forecast for next year, because they were basically holding it at, 3.1? Now they're saying it's going to be up again. And most of the other major economists are still saying more rates next year. The markets are saying more rates next year. Mm-hmm. We already know that the pressure on households is building because of course, the 3% from ultra-low rates. And we also know that the original APRA buffer was 3%, previously 2%. So we're now actually in, pressurised territory from all perspectives, and yet rates are going to go higher.
Yes, look, the buffer being breached now is really a worry, because, rate increases have been unknown territory for a huge number of borrowers until they first hit in May. And I don't think even the professionals expected that we would get rate increases of 3% from the Reserve Bank in 8 months. That's kind of it's so unprecedented. Yep. That it caught me by surprise, and I think it would have caught most people by surprise. So no one expected that. Now, what that means is that 3% buffer is the buffer that. Just to explain that, just in case some people aren't aware of this, APRA says to the banks, you must assess based on an interest rate that is 3% higher than the rate that you're actually charging the customer, so that we built in a reasonable buffer for that future that is higher interest rates. What we've seen now is that over the 8 months, that 3% has been breached, and people who borrowed a little bit further back didn't even have 3% as the buffer. So not only is this unknown for the borrower, but in a lot of ways it's also unknown territory for the bank, because the bank assessed whether you could repay your loan at a rate 3% higher than it was in April, and now it's hit that point, and come February next year, it's probably going to be another 0.25%. So it's even unknown territory for the bank in that sense, because they haven't confirmed the borrowers who borrowed back then in April or earlier, they haven't confirmed that borrower can afford this repayment. So that makes it unknown territory for the borrower and for the bank.
Yeah, and also another factor, of course, is because the expenditure measure that they use, the HEM, right, was based on a certain formulation back then, right? Now, if you look at what's happened to inflation and therefore the cost of living, they're a lot higher. In other words, people are spending more on other things than would have been assumed when they made their assessment. So not only is this 3% buffer a problem, but the affordability aspect is also there too. And the borrowing power of households, well, it's dropped considerably. In some cases now it's more than 30% lower than where it was before the rate rise cycle started. So again, another source of pressure.
Yeah, it is. I hadn't mentioned that, but you're right, absolutely right. Nobody, the other thing nobody quite expected was 8% inflation. That's what the Reserve Bank says we're going to have in the December quarter. So nobody expected that. So you put 8% over and above the hem of a year ago, and yeah, it's a lot higher. And you know, the bank makes the decision based on the facts in front of it, and the 3% buffer is the thing that allows for future pressures. But you know, probably you've got to say, well, look, if you have an interest rate that goes up 3%, it's gone up by 3% because you've got inflation. So it's a double whammy, and allowing for it once in the repayment is probably flawed because you've got to allow for it in the hem as well as the repayment. And I guess people, as in lenders and APRA, didn't really expect that 3% was going to happen anyway. So didn't perhaps for that reason didn't really address the hem. Now, of course, they'll say, well, look, we expect banks to make a judgment based on the real numbers, not just the hem. But if you're encouraging fast approvals and the like, well, you know, it's virtually got to be hem, hasn't it? So yeah, it's a double whammy, unfortunately, and it's going to hurt a lot of people. And you know, repayments have gone up by $880 on $500,000 loan already, and they'll be $1,000 up if it gets to the 3.85% that a number of the banks are predicting. So yeah, it's tough times.
And it's interesting that on Tuesday, when Philip Lowe released the statement, he did actually talk about the lag. And, you know, the fact is that we have not yet seen all of those higher rates and the other factors we've been talking about coming through. In other words, it's going to get worse before it gets better. And it's really interesting that I think that's the first time he's been so explicit in terms of this delay in the process.
Yeah. Matt Comyn, the chief executive of CommBank, came out months ago now, and he said that there's a three-month lag before it actually hits the customer repayments. Now, I struggle with that because I can't quite get it to 3 months, but it could be in some cases. And what happens is that, all right, the bank, the Reserve Bank makes its decision. The major banks come out pretty quickly, you know, almost always within a week, and say, yep, we're passing this on to our customers. Then they contact the customers and tell them it's going up, but they've set a date that's sort of 2 or 3 weeks from their decision. And so that's all still within the month of the RBA increase. And the next month you should be expecting that at least some of those customers will be seeing the repayment. So it could get out to 2.5 months, I guess, but generally it's more like a two-month lag. So in other words, the RBA makes the announcement and you see your repayment go up 2 months later. But depending on what time of the month your repayment is, it could be 3 months later. And that's where the lag comes in. And people then see a higher repayment. And it doesn't, they kind of manage it for the first month or two, and the pressure comes on a month or two later. So there is quite a lag between announcement of the RBA or the RBA decision and the time when it really bites, which is why reserve banks around the world are sort of nervous about, you know, the future, because, all right, they've got that lag before they see the impact of their decision. And they also have a lag in the time that it takes to get reasonable statistics to base their decision on. Now, the Reserve Bank has addressed that with the ABS to get an estimate monthly of inflation, because for years and years they made these decisions based on quarterly data, which is so out of date at certain times of the year. It's mind-boggling. But anyway, they're getting monthly data and it's an estimate, and you know, there are all sorts of riders on it, but it's probably good enough anyway. But it means that the decision making is based on lagged reaction time to what it means to consumers, and then lagged reporting time in terms of that, of data. So it is a tough job.
Absolutely. And then, of course, we've got the fixed rate problem. So we still know that there are a number of people with low repayments because they've got a fixed rate mortgage, which is going to then reset. And the RBA is saying there's going to be a bit of a peak in the middle of next year. So, you know, assuming that the cash rate's 3% higher at least, that means that the mortgage rate's going to be 3% higher at least. Yes. So going from 2% to 5% or worse. And that's another significant shock for a lot of households.
Yeah, look, doubling the interest rate is a real problem. Doubling it over a period where you've kind of been conditioned to it, and you say, all right, I've got to make some decisions and I've got to sort of start working out how I'm going to deal with this, and I'll have to start trimming the budget to make sure I can deal with it, and I've got to make some tricky decisions on the way through about all of this. But at least you're making them gradually and saying, okay, now I've got time, I can deal with this. These people are going to be hit one-off with a doubling of their interest rates, because a lot of them were borrowing around 2%. You double an interest rate overnight and your repayments double, more or less, you know, and it's not quite true, but anyway, you know how it works, Martin. Yep. it's a terrible shock, and I think, I hope people are realizing what's coming down the pipe, because you can be very complacent about it and very relieved that this isn't affecting you, and you can be doing these and saying, what a clever fella I am. Plan now, because this will hit you like a ton of bricks if you're not ready.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I think we've said before, you should be starting to put some extra money aside into the offset account, get yourself disciplined to paying the higher rate, because you know it's coming. And interestingly, in my looking at my distribution on my surveys, the fixed rate holders tend to have bigger mortgages than the variable rate ones, which is interesting.
Yeah, I didn't know that. All right. Yeah. Okay, well, that's interesting. I suspect that would be because there are people who can afford more expensive houses and potentially are more engaged in financial decision making. So they've switched when they've seen the opportunity. I suspect that's the reason. Have you got another theory?
No? So there's one is that. So people are more switched on, and actually, in some cases, they split their loan between fixed and variable. So they're seeing some increase now, but they know that they've got this fixed element, and it's quite often a bigger mortgage because it's a more expensive property. First point. The second one is that in some cases they were worried about not being able to afford their mortgage if rates started to rise. So they decided they needed the security or insurance of the fixed rate, and that tends to be those with a larger mortgage and are more leveraged. Unfortunately, it's those that I'm concerned about, because that very leverage, that very, you know, significant exposure is what's going to really hit them. So, again, it's really important to plan ahead and think about how to tackle it, because it's going to come. And there are a few property spruikers who are saying, rates will be back down in a few months, everything's fine, the market's going to take off again. I'm afraid they're living in cloud cuckoo land. You know, even the RBA is saying rates are going to stay high because the inflation is not going to come back into within target for a long, long time. You know, maybe year after next. The market is saying 3.6% is a cash rate over the next year plus, and that's probably a reasonable sort of middle of the road bet at the moment. Some saying more. So you can't just live on hopium here. You've got to actually have a strategy.
Yes, look, don't listen to the property spruikers. That's a good start to your strategy. They're also saying, I've seen them saying also that interest rates, house prices having fallen around 7% or whatever it is right now. Won't go any further. That's all we'll see, and we'll see a recovery in house prices in the next whatever. Yeah. And they would say these things. I don't think they're in cloud cuckoo land. I think they're in cloud self-interest.
The two are somewhat aligned. I think you're spot on there. And, you may know I publish a series of what I call anti-spruik videos where I show recent price falls in a particular area because I'm so fed up with all of those spruikers who, by the way, attach themselves sometimes to my YouTube ads at the start of my shows, which I chuckle about. But the fact is that they've got an agenda which is not necessarily aligned to the people they're talking to. That's their own agenda.
Well, look, if you make a living selling property, you want people to keep buying property. Yeah. You don't want the mother of all downturns that lasts for 2 or 3 years. And you think, well, where's my income gone? What about me?
Exactly right. Now, let's talk about another very weird situation, credit cards, because, in fact, the credit card story is a really interesting one. Overall credit card debt dropped significantly over the last 2 or 3 years. The number of cards in circulation also came down. But we are seeing some rather worrying trends now in the credit card sector, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. Let me just talk about the last couple of years first, and then to give it a little bit of context. What happened during the COVID years, we saw something like $11 billion carved off credit card debt. It could have been higher. I should have looked it up. But it was a huge number. And at the time, I was saying, look, this is all about the early release of superannuation. And I don't think you had to look any further than that to say, that magnitude of drop in credit card debt hasn't just come because people are not going out to restaurants and clubs. It's because they raided their super and said, I can finally get rid of this credit card millstone around my neck. And a lot of people didn't believe me. They said, oh, how do you know? I said, well, come on, just bring two and two together. Now, what then happened when that program finished is that we kept seeing a fall, a very, very gradual fall. But over the last 12 months, it's hardly fallen at all. I'm looking down at data now, and the debt on cards today is $16.89 billion, and it was $17.08 billion a year earlier. Now, that's nothing. That's sort of like $100 million difference. So it hasn't changed in all that time. It has kind of plateaued, and people have spending has gone right up in credit cards. So that's the recovery in the economy and people going out to restaurants and stuff. Spending has gone right up, but people have kept it under control and not added to the debt that's on the card accruing interest. So that's a really good thing. It's been a discipline. People are spending, obviously there's still a huge amount of debt, but generally people are spending money that they can afford with this increased spending. So that's a very good sign. What we're predicting is, though, a massive increase, which is a seasonal increase in credit card spend in the next 2 months. That will really start testing people when the cost of living has gone up, cost of their borrowing has gone up, their home loan has gone up, and they're spending more for Christmas, which they do every year, and we see it every year go up. It's not a trivial amount. We had a record spend on credit cards in August of $26 billion. We've done a little bit of crystal ball gazing and said, look, it could be $29 billion in December. Now, obviously, we don't quite know because of the October sales, the Black Friday and all that stuff has changed the pattern a bit. But we've looked at the last 4 years or something, and we've looked at how much it goes up from October through to November, then December, and it escalates. Whether it's $29 billion or $28 billion, that's a lot of extra spending. And we think a lot of that might find its way onto credit cards. So it's quite problematic if people find themselves funding Christmas 2022 and put it onto onto the credit card and hopefully not onto the never never. But if they still find themselves not able to repay it over the next 3 or 4 months, they're paying a high interest rate compared to anything else. And if you find yourself hitting Christmas 2023 and you still haven't cleared it, well, that's really problematic. Now, there's an interesting stat that comes from one of the big ratings agencies, and they're saying that credit card applications were up by 31.5% in the September quarter. Now, people are applying for credit cards, and even though, you know, overall we're not quite seeing it in the numbers yet, the applications are right up. And you know, it's people are taking out credit cards right now for a reason. And the reason might be that they're expecting a bit of stress on their household budget.
And I can tell you that in my surveys, the distribution is the important thing here. So those additional credit cards are very much aligned to those who have financial cash flow issues, as is, of course, the higher balances, the revolving balances on the card. So the average, unfortunately, masks the one-third of people who hardly use credit at all and the one-third who pay off every month fine. But there's a third who are really, frankly, extending themselves through credit and using credit cards, getting more credit cards. And in fact, if you count up the number of credit cards the average stress household has, it's considerably larger than other households. So it's the unequal distribution of the debt that I'm concerned about. And you make a really important point. Interest rates on credit card debt is painfully high, isn't it?
The average credit card interest rate for non-rewards cards is 14.34%. It's higher for rewards cards. The maximum rate you can pay on a credit card is 23.95%. That is just outrageous. That's just a crazy rate. And the minimum, though, is 7.49. Now, that's a kind of one-off, but then you get, you know, a number of cards in the sort of 11, 12% kind of band, you know, around 12%. Do not pay 23.95% on a card, even if it has magic rewards and all the other benefits. Do not pay if you are carrying debt on your card, because no interest, no rewards program that's on the market will compensate you for paying, you know, 23-24% interest if you're carrying a substantial debt on your card. Now, will you get into the card that 7.49%? Well, maybe not. Maybe you might not qualify. But look for a card that's at least around, you know, 12-13% if you have debt on the card. But your objective has to be to get rid of that debt, because that debt is going to hurt you for a long time if you don't clear it. You know, even with all the increases in home loan interest rates, they're still, you know, on average 5.45%. So even on the better cards, you're paying, you know, 2.5 times that in interest. So you've got to have an objective to get rid of your credit card debt early. Now, what does that mean? It means think hard about the spending you're doing when you're doing it. Now, if you've taken out a credit card to fund Christmas, you don't have to go top shelf on everything. And Christmas should be, you know, about friends, family, stuff like that, not necessarily about things. And, you know, you don't, it sounds to, you know, like, you know, too Grinch-like to be saying, look, cut back over Christmas. But it says, you know, sort of maybe just think about it. Think about it a little bit harder. You know, do you need to go that extra step all the time, or can you just, you know, do things that matter and enjoy it? But don't build yourself through one great Christmas. Don't build yourself into, lock yourself into a 12-month hangover.
I think that's very good advice, and particularly in the current environment. And two observations. One is there's an alignment between buy now, pay later and some of these card growth. And, of course, more than 20% of people who use buy now, pay later ending up getting hit with late fees on the buy now, pay later element, as well as the interest rates on the card. So buy now, pay later is not a free money tree. The other interesting observation that I see now is that when people are refinancing, people quite often are still pulling more equity out of their property to be able to pay off the credit card debts and the other debts that they've got. Now, that may be sensible because the interest rate is lower, but when you're pulling equity out of your property, when interest rates are rising and values of property are falling, you are effectively destroying the equity that you've got, your buffers, effectively. So that is a trick that many people are using, in fact, more are using than previously, but is not necessarily that sensible. But by the way, it's being spun by the banks and spun by mortgage brokers as a way to get out of the problem they've got.
Yeah. If you... let's say you've got a $500,000 mortgage and you've got a $15,000 credit card debt. It does sound appealing, and it does help your immediate cash flow position. If you roll the $15,000 into your loan, and it looks a great strategy because you're on a lower interest rate. If you do it though, you're now repaying your $15,000. What's credit card debt, you're repaying it over the next 30 years. Yeah, that doesn't make a lot of sense at all, and it blows out the repayment a heck of a lot if you do it. The second point that you're alluding to is that when you go and refinance, the bank will be thinking 30-year loan, the new bank. They'll be thinking 30-year loan because that's what we write loans over. And you're refinancing, so you're refinancing, you've got a lower interest rate but also a lower repayment. So we'll write you a 30-year loan. Now, you know, that's all very well, but you've and it sort of looks good for the cash flow and you sort of think, well, life's good. But it means that you don't repay your loan until, you know, another maybe 5 or 10 years longer than you were originally projected to. And there's nothing like clearing a home loan, clearing a fixed commitment to give you the opportunity to free up the space to start genuinely building to a comfortable retirement. Yeah, that's when you can seriously start building some wealth because the cash flow that was going into the loan now goes towards building your wealth for the future. And it just can put you way behind because of that sheer lack of thinking about, look, bumping a short-term commitment into a long-term loan and secondly, extending the loan term. Now I'm not naive enough to think that people won't do it because you know, at some point, if your financial position is absolutely too stressed right now, you do have to survive the short term to get into the long term. And I'm talking about long-term damage here, not short-term damage. So if you have to, if you get absolutely desperate, well, maybe it is one of the potential solutions to your current situation. But it says, look, things will get better. Now, this too will pass and things will get better. And you have to review your situation in a few years' time and say, look, now I can afford to repay a higher amount than the bank says I've got to pay. What would I have to do to put myself back on the trajectory I was originally on so that I can clear the loan in that same time frame and not sort of be working till I'm 70 to repay the mortgage? But you've got to review it for yourself because the bank won't come and review it. You know, they won't say, look, you should be doing this now. You have to review it yourself so that you watch your own position. Now, I think a lot of people, unfortunately, will do the refinance thing and then say, yep, tick that one, I've done that, and not worry about it again. You can't afford to do that because you'll be further behind the eight ball in the long term.
Yeah, and if you don't change your behaviour, you'll end up with another pile of debt again down the track, and then you've got to, well, what are you going to do, refinance again and just kick it down the road again? Now, there are people doing that, but with interest rates where they are now, the consequences are quite dire. The other point is, you know, if you go into retirement still with a mortgage, that's a huge issue at that point, because then you've got a very limited range of options, which means pulling forward superannuation to pay off the mortgage, which means you've got a smaller pool for later, or indeed continuing to pay the mortgage into retirement when your income flow is probably a lot lower. Neither of those are very attractive options. Unfortunately, quite often the psychology is, well, I'll fix the short term and I'll let the long term look after itself. But it is important to have that longer term view as well, isn't
Yeah, look, we've seen a lot of that in recent years where people are retiring still with a mortgage, and a couple of $100,000 of their superannuation disappears the day they retire because they say, okay, well, I've got to get rid of the mortgage, obviously, pay it in there, and now I'm going to be a part pensioner for a few years and then a full pensioner, and that will click in a lot earlier than you would have expected. And it's a problem for individuals, of course, because their lifestyle's affected. It's also a problem for the country because, I mean, at the end of the day, superannuation came in 1991, and we still have people who, who are retiring on an amount that just is so much lower than you would have thought. You know, Paul Keating would never have thought we'd have as many part-time pensioners and full pensioners today as we do. You know, the whole plan of this was that we would just remove that burden from future generations. Well, it hasn't quite come to play out that way.
No, not least because, of course, the amount of debt that households have has gone through the roof, chasing high house prices, mm-hmm. and so we are a debt-ridden society, and that then creates all these knock-on effects. Now, before we close, what we should just talk about briefly is deposit rates, because, well, there's some mixed news there too, right? Because we started to see deposit rates move up a little, but some of those higher rates have dropped back a little now.
What we've seen is that the background here, of course, is that the deposit rates fell for 10 years, and that's not overestimated. Now, depositors were very patient and gritting their teeth and saying, well, it's not right, but here we are. And they've expected a time to come which is now, when rates would start to rise, and they're expecting that, cycles come, cycles go, and we will get our day in the sun. It could be now, but it's not, because they're getting half a day in the sun, not the full day in the sun. And what's happened is that banks are increasing savings rates, but not at the same pace that they're increasing borrowing rates. So home loans go up. Home loans have gone up basically in line with the increase in the Reserve Bank cash rate. So they've gone up 3%, and there's sort of certainty taxes and your interest rate going up if the Reserve Bank moves up. Unfortunately, we've seen interest rates on savings accounts go up by about half of that amount in a lot of cases. And there are three ways that it happens. One is the bank will put out an announcement of actually four ways. I'll say four ways. They'll put out an announcement about the home loan rate, but take another 2 weeks to put out the announcement on savings rates. So first up, they bought themselves extra time on that. Now, they'd probably argue, and it might be true, that it takes longer to get the interest rate up on the home loan rate. So maybe I'll give them the benefit of the doubt there. The second way they do it is that they'll have two different savings accounts, and one of the accounts will be, say, a bonus savings account, and the other one will be just a regular savings account, what we used to call an online savings account. They all are now, though. So 1 month, in May, after the increase, they'll have bumped up their bonus account, but not their online account. And then next month they might bump up the online account, but not the bonus account. So that's another way they've done it. You only get the increase on your account every second month. Second way they do it is that they have rarely passed on the full 0.25 or 0.5 increase. It's normally been a 0.15 or a 0.2 or something like that. So they've now pocketed another 0.10% or 0.20%. On the increase. The third way they'll do it is that they won't increase the base rate. Now, a lot of accounts have a base rate, which is just the regular rate you get, and then they have a promotional rate that sits on top of that exists for the first 2, 3, 4, 5 months of the account, and then you go back to the base rate. So a lot of the increase has been applied not to the base rate, but to the introductory promotional rate. And unfortunately, existing customers don't see that. They only get the increase to the base rate, not the promotional rate. You've got to swap banks to get the promotional rate. So they haven't passed that on either. So we've seen a real disparity arise between the bank's reaction to increasing rates on home loans and increasing rates on savings accounts. The accounts that have done best in the period have been the bonus savings accounts. Now, I didn't talk about those before. I'll talk about them now. So the bonus savings accounts, the increases on average are about, say, 2.75%, and compared to the Reserve Bank increase and the mortgage rate increase of 3%, that's not bad. That's almost all of it compared to straight base rate accounts, which have only gone up by about half of the Reserve Bank movement. Now, that's just outrageous, to be honest. And likewise, with the promotional rates, the base rates have only gone up by about half of the Reserve Bank increase. So it's been a terrible outcome for savers, having lived through this 10 years of declining savings interest rates, to now say, yeah, now we're only getting half of it back, and we're getting to the tail end of the Reserve Bank increases, and we've only got half of it back. It means people have to work a lot harder with their savings to get a good rate.
Yeah, and it's also worth underscoring, shop around again, because the best rates and the worst rates, whether you look at term deposits or whether you look at other types of savings accounts, are hugely diverse, right? So you cannot rely on your bank giving you the best rate.
No, you can't. And they're professional managers of interest rate and interest rate margin. So interest rate margin is just they get 5% on a loan and they pay 2% on a deposit. They've made 3% difference. Now, on average, they don't make 3% anymore. They make about 1.6% or something. But if they can make 3% out of some customers and on other parts of their funding make just 1.25%, well, that's how they get to an average of 1.6. So they're professionals doing that, and you can't expect them to necessarily pass it on if they don't have to. They've come out of COVID with more deposits than they have ever had, so they don't feel desperate to have to chase deposits. You've got to really hunt around, and you can get rates of 3.45% up near 4% on savings accounts, but you've got to pick the right institutions. Some of them are big banks, big international banks, and the like. Not the big four banks, but they're second tier banks. So you've got to look for those rates. If you can get 4% on a savings account, that's a pretty good deal. And then you've got term deposits. If you're in a position where you can lock away some of your money for a period, then you can look at term deposit rates up towards 4.5-5% if you lock it away for 5 years or 4 years. So think about that. Maybe not for all of your money, but for part of your money. Obviously you've got money that you expect to have to live on or expect to use for a purpose. But then you've also got cash that you can lock away. So split your money up. It's not all or nothing. You can play the game any way you want to. And term deposit rates are a pretty good option at 3 years too. So, mix it up if you like. Mix your maturities. Have some maturing in 2 or 3 years' time, some in 3 or 4 years' time, etc. So that you don't get that remorse if rates unexpectedly go a lot higher than we thought. There are opportunities there, manage your money. And just a reminder about the Reserve Bank, the government guarantee on deposits with Australian deposit-taking institutions, they are guaranteed. So just because you haven't heard of some of these providers before, if they're an ADI, Australian deposit-taking institution, and you keep your deposit down below $250,000, which most of us can manage, then you don't have to feel that for security purposes you're with one of the big four banks that you see on every street corner.
actually less street corners because they keep closing branches, but that's
a whole other
issue which we won't touch on today.
No, I keep saying that, Martin. I've been saying that for 30 years, though.
Yeah, no, indeed. But it is important to shop around. It is important to, understand your finances. And I guess as we come to the end of this conversation, end of the year coming up fast, over the next little while, what homework would you give households over the sort of the Christmas period to get their finances ready for next year?
Look, the first on everyone's list, first on everyone's list as a borrower is to look at your home loan rate and then go into Canstar and check out the lowest rates in the market. And if you're more than 0.3-0.4% higher, consider doing something about it. Now, that could be renegotiating with your own bank. It could be going to another bank. But, don't pay away too much. And the reason people should put that first on the list is, well, twofold. One is that it's the biggest expense and will make the biggest difference in financial services and probably in any of your household expenses. It's the biggest one that will make the most difference. So address that one first. Check it out. Check out the rate you're paying, compare it with the rate you can get, and look at doing it now. And the second reason is that it's at the top of the list is that if times do get a lot tougher, there'll be a lot of people out there who will say, I'm not even able to get the bank interested in refinancing me. I can't find another alternative. And I'm locked in. I'm now a hostage with my own bank at a rate that might not be that appealing. So get into that one first. But then set yourself a timetable for the next 12 months. And every month, every 2 months at most, deal with another one of the big ticket items. So, look at your health insurance in February, having done your home loan in January. Look at your electricity bill in March, et cetera, right through the year. So set yourself a program that says every month I will deal with one of these issues. And, at the end of that period, you've covered a lot of the extra costs that inflation has thrown at you in your grocery bill and every other cost you've got, and you've made room for really proofing yourself from further difficulty, further financial problems. You can save yourself thousands of dollars every year if you follow this sort of approach. So that, to me, is where you go. Set your plan, but hit your home loan first.
Yeah, so knock over the big items and then do the rest. And I would also add to that, worth understanding what your current rates are, because quite often people don't know what rates they're getting on their, being charged on their loan or on their deposit. And the other is many people still don't have a real strong sense of a cash flow. So I think in the current environment, knowing how things are and how it's going to shape out, building a cash flow so you can see where the money's coming in, where it's going out, so that you can prioritize effectively against that is the other thing that I would add it into the homework. Because, I don't think the next year is going to be a very comfortable year for many households, but the message I think is that there are things that you can do now to alleviate some of those pressures and rather than putting your head in the sand and saying, oh, nothing I can do, no, there are things that you can actually take action on. And now is the time to be thinking about that rather than leaving it until sort of the middle of next year or beyond when rates are going to be higher and things are going to be worse.
Yeah, look, absolutely right, Martin. Financial well-being is about money that comes in and money that goes out. And it goes out in certain ways. Some you can't avoid, but you can trim the amount. And that's what I was talking about then. The other is that you have spending that you're doing maybe is discretionary, even though you might look at some of these things and say, look, they're essentials of living. Some of them are essentials of living, but there's a discretionary element to them. You're paying more than you need to for certain things. So, you do have to understand where the money is going, how you're spending it, and what's your what's where you can make savings. So money in, money out, and your financial situation is always that combination of the two. A lot of people's financial problems, they might blame on a credit card or something, but at the end of the day, a lot of the problems are caused because of spending habits, and it's got very little to do in most cases with the actual financial product. It's that you've spent money that you actually couldn't ever afford to spend because you were given a mechanism to do it, which is the problem. But it's the spending that's the issue. Get that fixed and you might fix up a lot of your financial difficulties.
And that's a really important point, because this is about your behavior and how you treat finances and how you actually make spending decisions, which ultimately is the critical thing, right? And whilst you're being thrown deals left, right and center, and the advertisers will try and get you to buy, that's the consumer society that we're in. But the antidote to that is getting to know your finances, making sure that you've got a sense of what your cash flow is, and then making better decisions. And it comes actually back to education, it comes back to awareness. And sites like CanStar, where you can get good information to be able to make better decisions. There are things that you can do. And I think today, in the current environment, getting your arms around your finances should be the number one New Year resolution.
Yep. Agree totally, Martin. You review your behaviours and your spending, and review the products that you're in that are commitments. And get them all in order. And if you attack both sides of the balance sheet at once, then you're bound to end the next year in better shape.
Yeah, Steve. Well, thanks very much for your comments today, and indeed through the year. Really have appreciated the shows, and hopefully this has given a chance to get into more detail on some of those critical things. Because of course, on the mainstream, they sort of talk about it for 2 minutes and then go to something else, right? Whereas we go into a bit more depth. So thank you very much, and I'll look forward to picking up the baton in the new year and deal with the whatever comes next.
And have a great Christmas, Martin, and to everyone that watches this, the same, and good financial planning for next year.
Thanks, Steve. Have a great Christmas. See you in the new year. See ya.
See you, Martin.